I'm Bonnie Glaser, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In this episode of the China Power podcast, we're discussing China-Africa relations and the recent FOCAC summit. FOCAC is an acronym for the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. It serves as the official platform for relations between China and 53 African countries. FOCAC was established in 2000, and the first FOCAC summit was held in 2006. The recent FOCAC summit took place in September 2018 in Beijing. China has deepened its relationship with Africa in recent years, most notably through its significant investments in infrastructure. China's security ties with Africa have also been expanding, including weapons sales, training of local troops, peacekeeping activities, and the creation of China's first ever overseas military base in Djibouti. To explore the recent FOCAC summit and the trajectory of China-Africa relations, I'm joined by Chris Alden. Dr. Alden is a professor in international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and he is a senior research fellow with the South African Institute of International Affairs. His most recent co-edited book is titled China and Africa, Building Peace and Security Cooperation on the Continent. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
Thank you for the invite.
So to start with, could you give us a brief overview of the role of FOCAC in China-Africa relations?
Yeah, FOCAC, as you said, has started in 2000, and it serves really three functions. One is it puts on public display the nature of the relationship, where the relationship is. And it's a sort of opportunity to review the past 3 years. It runs every 3 years and reflect upon what has been accomplished. It also sets the agenda for what can be accomplished in the future. It establishes on the part of both sides, the Chinese and African side, project areas, programs, diplomatic initiatives, and the like, as targets for achievement in the coming 3 year period. And it also is an opportunity for leaders. There are a set of sub forums that are built around specific sectors where leaders get together, ministers, business people as well, and they can hold discussions around more particular issues.
China has sought to develop its relations with Africa through this platform. Can you explain what China's foreign policy objectives are that they're trying to advance, and then how do the African countries benefit from participating?
The general drivers of China's role on the continent have been, in the first instance, the economic drivers of resource and more recently market-seeking behavior. That's from the mid-1990s onward. But there's an overlay that one has to recognize of diplomatic political initiatives that binding together the relationship between Beijing and the respective African countries for which China believes, about which China believes there are a lot of affinities around questions of sovereignty, affinities around questions of global governance, and that sort of thing. So FOCAC, where FOCAC fits into this larger agenda, and it's an evolving one too, I should say. New issues come up over the years and are brought in on board, such as security. But the larger aim here is to build a relationship that is really Chinese and African in its sense. It's one which is shaped, the norms that underlie it in FOCAC and others and other cooperative ventures reflect the shared perspectives, outlooks of the two parties, the region, Africa, and China, the country.
So the recent summit, I understand that virtually every African country sent its top leader. Why are the Africans themselves so eager to engage in this process with Beijing? What do they get out of it?
They get, in the first instance, they get resources and they get attention. They get resources in the sense that China has deep pockets, financial pockets, development. Its role as a financier of development, infrastructure in particular, but not exclusively so, is obviously well known, and they have a track record at this stage in across Africa and building projects that others had perhaps the international financial institutions or donors had been more reluctant to support. So finance is part of it. On the diplomatic front, Africa has since the 1990s, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has made a point, with one exception, of putting African diplomats first on their annual calendar. That is to say, they'll do a tour of the continent or do a bilateral visit of one kind or another. And I think that this attention that is paid to African countries is well noted in the capitals of the African countries. It gives them a sense of their significance, that another developing country, emerging country, one with a Security Council seat, one at the heights of power, as it were, in the international system, is willing to reach out and give them the kind of focus that was frankly missing in amongst the other traditional European and U.S. powers.
At the recent FOCAC summit, what were some of the significant outcomes, and how did it compare to the meeting that was held, say, 3 years ago or 6 years ago? What really stood out to you?
In a sense, what stood out was how it felt to me that it was more of the same as of 2015. 2015 is notable because of the big bang announcements of $60 billion in various forms of finance, mostly concessional loans and the like, but some grant aid as well, and different sorts of financial incentives there. This really caught the attention of African leaders and the global community. We had a repetition of that number, albeit the carving up of the distribution of those funds in a somewhat different way. So in a sense, it wasn't that distinctive from the previous FOCAC. What was distinctive is partly the emphasis of what was missing. I think there was a lot less focus on the AU, the African Union, has something called Agenda 2063. The terminology and the projects that are featured in Agenda 63, which is a development agenda for the continent, are quite detailed. And if you look at the 2015 FOCAC Action Plan, there's a lot of kind of micro detail linking FOCAC and Chinese initiatives to particular interests and projects and the like. And there's been a backing away from that level of detail in that between the FOCAC initiative and the AU's Agenda 2063. There's some detail on security that was lacking in the past. 50 projects that aimed at training, technical training, linked to enhancing security capacity, intelligence sharing, crime, law, a forum on looking at policing and crime. So, you know, they're beginning to dig a little bit deeper into the security side of the equation. While security has been mentioned since 2012, since the announcement of at that FOCAC meeting of a partnership in peace and security, the details have really been lacking up to this stage.
You mentioned the financing component of the China-Africa relationship. Could you talk a bit about the impact of the Belt and Road on China-Africa relations, how it's playing on the continent? And I wonder how you view the statements that have been made by some people in the Trump administration, and I think by some other governments as well, that China's strategy towards Africa is one that encourages dependency using opaque contracts, predatory loan practices, and corrupt deals. Is this an accurate depiction of what is going on?
On the first point of BRI, I suppose I should have said that's also notable about this particular FOCAC meeting is that the Belt Road Initiative is integrated formally into the relationship between Africa and China. So that stands out as a further elaboration of what an evolution of what constitutes the Belt Road from a very narrow historical linkage to one that's beginning to expand to global proportions across most of the developing world. So I think that should be noted as distinctive. The meaning of the Belt Road Initiative, I think there's been a fair amount of, since its announcement in 2013, and subsequently since Chinese researchers, diplomats, and the like have been coming to the continent and speaking about this Belt Road Initiative, there's been a fair amount of, if not confusion, bemusement, not really certain what the Belt Road Initiative has to do with African interests and the like. So it's been a process of building that, of learning about and recognizing that, at least in the infrastructure side of things, and certainly on the East Coast and the Horn of Africa, that the Belt Road Initiative has a formal fit into what used to be called the Maritime Silk Road or Maritime component of it. And as the Chinese thinking about the Belt and Road has evolved, so too Africans have begun to see more opportunity in supporting infrastructure projects that or harbors and ports, rather, and these sort of things that will penetrate inland from the coast, the east coast of Africa or the Horn. So I think this convergence, beginning of convergence about what the Belt Road can mean, development financing in particular, and what Africa wants or needs. It should be recognized that this is a study of some years back, but they said that Africa can absorb a huge amount of infrastructure, annual infrastructure building, that it's falling far short. And so the Chinese component is very much a welcome, a financing for infrastructure is very much a welcome initiative from their perspective, whether it's branded as Belt Road, whether it's a FOCAC, whether it's bilateral. African governments see that as a positive sum game. That being said, some of this, they're also cautious about some of the issues raised by the Trump administration, even in their own or derived from their own experience of working with China. It's not a given that the particular projects and financing will produce the kind of infrastructure, the quality of infrastructure that they had hoped or wanted. So there are debates going on within African governments, certainly amongst civil society and business communities, saying, are we getting the infrastructure we want when we approach the Chinese? What are the costs of that? This debate that's coming out of Washington is also a kind of significant sideline of a sort of critical narrative of the Chinese role in development finance in Africa, by taking loans, Africans will be carrying a debt burden eventually of loans from China that will the debt burden will eventually make it impossible for that, or they'll be drawn back into the trap which they only newly emerged out of in the late 90s, early 2000s. Of high interest payments, all their revenue, government revenues directed towards just paying off the interest on loans. So this echoes strongly in African circles. This concern is very, very they're paying attention to it. The only caveat I would suggest is that they don't see this as exclusively a problem of dealing with China. it's about borrowing more generally, whether the origins happen to be China or it's done from another source, another bilateral or perhaps an international financial institution. So they're conscious of this in a general way. And the debt burdens that they do have are the Chinese-owned debt is only a portion of that. It's going to be part of a larger debt portfolio the governments have.
You write in your recent book about the security cooperation between China and Africa, really about the security elements of the relationship. And I wonder if you could elaborate on why security has become important in the China-Africa relationship, and where do you see these headed in the future?
Security is interesting, the sector. When China first really became involved in Africa, so I should say first, when this newest phase or this intensified phase from the mid-1990s onward began, the question of security was one which was studiously avoided. The Chinese flew the flag as they do of non-intervention and non-interference, and they really had no capacity, for that matter, to do anything in the security sphere. They were just beginning to roll out a few tentative movements in peacekeeping, engineering brigades or small groups of people in very particular, specialized, non-combatant roles. So that was beginning to happen and happening in places like Africa. As far as what they could deliver and their assessment of security, they really thought that things, they operated as if, one, there wasn't a security issue, and secondly, they had no substantive role in it. Their view on that changed. It changed partly because once you have sunk economic interests, and with that human personnel, Chinese citizens, Chinese companies in a given country, one which may or may not be as stable as you believe it to be, you begin to become exposed to the various risks that more longstanding foreigners, foreign companies recognize. So I think that this gradual process of becoming exposed to becoming more involved, the threats of economic nationalism, which periodically emerge, particularly resource nationalism, as promoted by different African governments, and for that matter, governments in Latin America and elsewhere, this also became an issue in certain countries. So, hostage taking of some Chinese nationals, all these sorts of things began to build a crescendo of within circles in Chinese circles in Africa and eventually circles in Beijing, that they had to do something more about this. The culmination of this thinking, or the tipping point of this thinking, comes in 2011 with the NATO bombing, with the Arab uprising, and in particular in the collapse of Libya and the NATO bombing, where the Chinese have to evacuate over 35,000 citizens. They didn't even know they had that number there. 2004, I've seen research which suggests that before 2004, there were only about 100 Chinese in Libya itself. So things changed fairly rapidly, and they were exposed to the dangers of not just loss of business, but loss of life, and exposed at home to criticism for not doing what nationalist-oriented governments ought to do, which is preserve and protect their citizenry and their economic commercial interests. So all of these things, I think, are part of the reason that China has had to rethink its relationship with security. I mentioned before that 2012 is when we first see a formal commitment at the FOCAC of that year to a China-Africa Partnership for Peace and Security. And that's a direct relationship to this change in thinking from before the period. I need to mention one other thing that also factors in, which is China's role in Sudan. Sudan was has been a unique case in the sense that China was one of its largest overseas investments had been in Sudan from the late 1990s and onward. And at one stage, in fact, 8-9% of its oil imported from abroad came from the Sudanese sources. It was in Sudan, in the build-up to that China discovered its international reputation was endangered by the behavior of the government, the Sudanese government, that it was guilty, if you like, by association, whether it wanted to be associated with, whether it flew the flag of non-interference, we don't interfere thing. It didn't matter that it felt that way. Other African governments, Western governments, were critical of Beijing for that association. So in that context, China realized that it had to be more more forward acting and begin to reflect more, reflect some of the changes about questions of intervention. It can happen, it can be multilateral, requires consensus, perhaps by regional or sub-regional organizations. But there was a sort of revolution of thinking that changed, also helped China rethink some of its understandings of risk and security in the African context.
There's been a lot of attention paid to what has now emerged as a military base in Djibouti. Of course, China's not the only nation to have a military base there. The United States does. I think France and the Japanese have some presence. What purpose does the base in Djibouti serve for China? And do you think that the Chinese have an interest in establishing additional military bases on the continent?
Well, the base in Djibouti is long in the making. That's the first thing I should say, is that ever since China in December 2008 joined the anti-piracy maritime initiatives, multilateralist maritime initiatives, that been something that the Navy had been publicly saying that they wanted or felt they needed a base, and so, you know, for resupply, rest and replenishment, all those sorts of things. So that argument had been at play for some time, and discussions and had been held apparently between Djibouti and other places and Beijing for some time. So that component of the argument, I think, is recognized by as both longstanding and quite a valid one. The other functions, so this also relates to a great trading nation. China, of course, is a global trading nation par excellence, and it in that position, it needs to protect and preserve the sea lanes and open communication and all of that kind of thing. It's in the context of the Suez Canal and the piracy off of the Horn, it's got a stake in making sure that these sea lanes are open, and this is one way of achieving that. There are also, linking back to the comments I made a moment ago about the security of Chinese interests, the concern for Chinese citizens abroad who might get caught up in instability or various civil conflicts or what have you, the basing of some Chinese rapid reaction force. I've seen different figures on this, 4,000. Some have suggested it's double that number. But that by basing them in Djibouti, that this is a very, for the same reason the U.S. and the French have based their equivalent forces there, that it's a very good posting area from which to respond to North Africa, the Horn, or just across the water in places like Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Gulf and what have you. So I think it's strategic in that particular sense, and can meaningfully, has demonstrated that it can meaningfully help China extract as necessary citizens and others, or contribute to that sort of those missions where they need to happen. Are they looking for other bases? This is rumors abound that the west coast of Africa, there's a search for that, for bases, and around the Gulf of Guinea, southern Africa. So we have some anecdotal evidence that that's occurring. Certainly the movement of the Chinese Navy is suggestive, and the anti-piracy, bilateral anti-piracy campaigns in the Gulf of Guinea, where, again, oil is sourced from that area, and there are concerns for the Chinese, as with others. There are also these, just as in Djibouti, just as in other parts of the world, in Pakistan and Sri Lanka and these places, you do have an alignment of basing the establishment of commercial harbor and some discussions, if not actual implementation of basing, sorts of military basing arrangements or dual-purpose, dual-usage arrangements. And there have been discussions about whether Bagamoyo in Tanzania is one of those, supposed to be $10 billion. It's a project that would certainly suggest a complex, development-oriented, and with a naval, something that could have a naval presence as well.
As you noted, the China-Africa relationship has evolved. So finally, if I could ask, if you look into your crystal ball, what changes do you foresee in the relationship in the coming years, perhaps out to the next decade?
Crystal ball glazing, always a difficult one. But I think that based on the trajectory, that, you know, assuming things don't, there isn't a kind of reverse one way or the other. But the trajectory is one of deepening involvement, deepening economic involvement. With that, the attendant security concerns we've mentioned. I think that certain issues, such as Chinese migration, will complicate what could be a strong and if managed well on the part of the African side, a strong and constructive development relationship. If not managed well, if corrupted or untransparent processes occur, as the record has shown, you then end up with some very difficult and non-developmental outcomes. So I think that's that feature. But I do think that the population, the migration element, changes for the ordinary African what the relationship is like. It's not just about financing and development at that level, but it's about either integration or competition in different sectors and in small towns and that sort of thing. So I think the relationship will only become more complicated, built around that deepening. Security itself, I think the Chinese have yet to, they've had a great awakening perhaps with the 2011 in Libya, but they haven't had they have only begun to invest in security, and they really haven't faced the actual complexity of managing with their counterparts in Africa a real emergency, a real crisis. It will be interesting to see where that puts Beijing and Africa and how that would impact on the relationship in the future.
We've been talking with Dr. Chris Alden, who's a professor in international relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.